Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody back, the hardcore who's staying on for the last of our sessions of the day today. And it's really a final roundtable where we thought we use the opportunity to recap on some of the key themes that came out of the discussions over the day, and also really think about the issue of next steps, like how can we take things forward, and particularly as well, what are perhaps interesting ideas we could brainstorm together on what are interesting and new avenues for research as well to pursue. So I'd like to introduce two new panelists as well we have for the roundtable. Next to me it's Paul Hammett, who is the National Water Resource Specialist for the National Farmers Union, and Ronan Palmer, who is the Chief Economist for the Environment Agency. So it's great that we've got some extra perspectives and voices kind of contributing as well here to the last roundtable, of course in connection as well with Bill Harris and Mark. So I thought I won't really try to sort of summarize key themes from the workshop. We discussed lots of really various different points, but there are three key issues that sort of came for me out of the discussions. And first of all, I thought it was really interesting to see sort of on an analytical level that what appear to be sometimes perhaps the taken for granted common currency of talking about water stewardship, there were actually a number of contested issues underneath. And first of all, for example, when we started off with that working definition of water stewardship and the first panel in the introduction, Mark and me, we started off with the definition of water stewardship that harked back to care for property and property ownership. And it was very interesting to see kind of in Alice's first slide, her sort of perspective on water stewardship immediately got into saying the importance as well of the unowned environment. So property wasn't anymore really the first starting point. So some really potentially quite different routes into there as well, thinking the idea of what are perhaps as well some of the moral drivers behind the idea of water stewardship. And I think the issue kind of about analytically how we use terms in different ways, sometimes in similar ways, was very interesting as well. So the point this morning that Bill made about how we think about water scarcity. So while the legal framework maybe first of all directs us to think about it, there's that volume of water that is being abstracted under the license, and that is potentially perhaps a too narrow way of thinking about it. And there might be a broader way of thinking about it from a risk-based perspective that says it's very important to see as well not just what the abstractor takes out and to discuss that and how it should be qualified through stewardship, but what is it that goes back into the hydrological cycle? And perhaps in terms of how the regulatory framework could differently deal with it, it seems to me currently abstraction charging sort of doesn't really take account of that, and perhaps there's an opportunity there for an economic incentive mechanism to say, well, what we really need to look at as well is to determine what comes in a diffuse way, kind of back from what originally was abstracted under the license, and water abstraction charging maybe should somehow take account of that. I thought it was really interesting as well that we saw in the discussions, as well sort of in the cross-disciplinary perspective that came out from the debates, that there are various different challenges, I think, towards developing further knowledge about water stewardship. And I think, again, it was very interesting to see in Alice's presentation how valuable it is as well to sort of really pull through the arguments and to see if we are considering the value of different types of water trading models, if we're having the simple paired model, if we're having sort of the common pool, more complex model, what can we really kind of say then as well, what the impact of these different trading regimes are on how the water resource behaves in the catchment? Are we really seeing sort of water conservation being facilitated? What's really happening overall there? So I think it's extremely valuable kind of to make those connections to really sort of pull the argument through and gain evidence like that. And I think it's really helpful as well for, while sort of evidence-based public policy making is as well a really problematic buzzword, I guess, on one level, but it's very helpful and important as well, again, and perhaps as well useful as a sort of counterbalance to the more ideological ways of approaching these big debates about should we have the markets, markets fail as well, should we have stewardship that really is focusing on the state. So I think sort of the reminder with the questions about privatization was really helpful kind of to say, well, the big ideas are behind that. But also I thought it was really interesting to see the nitty-gritty evidence. So how do we judge, can the market provide stewardship and generating knowledge about that, I think is really, really interesting and important. And I thought it was really interesting as well, kind of how Bill's comment was bringing out that in terms of developing this more cross-disciplinary conversation about water stewardship, and I guess water regulation is exactly an issue that sort of makes it important that we have different disciplinary input, how problematic that sometimes can be as well, with sort of the economist's perspective of thinking about a common pool resource in a very particular way, whereas perhaps again sort of lawyers and the legal framework steers us to think about rivers in the first instance and much more as a sort of sequential thing, the rights to the river, along the river, how what's happening upstream is affecting downstream, how the common law deals with that, and so forth, and how that's quite different from the slightly more abstract way of the common pool resource that the economist sort of refers to when thinking about managing a water resource. And just as a last third point, I thought it was really interesting as well that the discussions brought out the complexities and difficulties involved in finding the right legal arrow to hit the target. So I think we heard really interesting points as well in the first presentation this morning from Karen, and sort of mapping out the universe of property law, of public law, of international public law, of human rights law, of statutory provisions, all with their different logics, values, and strategies for contributing to thinking about rights to water. And I guess what that brought out for me as well is to kind of see that the sort of different legal provisions provide different meaning fragments on how we can start to think about a right of water, but it becomes difficult to draw that together, that there's a unified fundamental right to water version that could be sort of distilled to that. I think the point about fragmentation as well further in water regulation from Bill again brought that out, kind of how we don't have really that very unified vision. And I think finally, kind of in sort of thinking about behavior and conceptions in relation to thinking about rights and regulatory regimes, there were the questions raised about the potential promise of social legal research. So what is it kind of that can contribute towards thinking about rights and regulation? And does it lead us to think that perhaps the legal categories aren't that important in order to frame our thinking about that? But then I thought it was really interesting as well to see a qualification of that as well from Sandra's talk on saying kind of that the public and private sometimes is one of the key organizing categories as well in legal systems can be actually quite helpful to sort of organize thinking about how is water stewardship here actually approached. So I just sort of wanted to sort of throw that into the conversation at the beginning to kick off and pull a couple of ideas together. And I think it might be really useful kind of to go around the panel and ask our panelists what else they want to contribute in terms of their key responses to thinking about rights and regulatory regimes, and as well where they see kind of the next steps are in terms of what are sort of major gaps in knowledge we have in understanding more about making water stewardship work. And particular people kind of who have to deal as well with the legal regulations, where would they find it helpful to have further knowledge generated? Shall we maybe just sort of...
Okay. thank you, Bettina. So I'm Paul Hammett. For the last few months, I've been the National Water Resource Specialist for the NFU. But I have worked on behalf of the farming community in East Anglia for a few decades. And the first thing I've thought about as I've listened very carefully to lots of the conversations today is where we were as a farming community during the droughts of the early 1990s, because I was there. And I remember two events in particular. I remember the Environment Agency gathering a group of fenland farmers who were wholly reliant on surface water for their irrigation crop needs. And the Environment Agency said, not really sorry, but the water is going to run out. And I remember well the look of shock and horror on farmers' faces as they realised the severity of the situation. So that's in terms of surface water. Secondly, at the same time, some of our groundwater abstractors in Suffolk received out of the blue letters from the then NRA informing them that sadly there would be no more water for the rest of the summer and that they must immediately stop irrigating. And that led to an utter furore within the agricultural community, as you can imagine. And then I fast forwarded to 2012. And the situation we had then was that whilst we still have a lot to deal with in the farming community, when we got to last year, a lot of those fenland farmers had built their own reservoir capacity. And a lot of the groundwater abstractors in Suffolk had formed themselves into groups abstractor groups to jointly collaborate in terms of decision-making processes. And those are the interesting thing for me was those are the sort of ideas we heard about this morning, and those are the ways in which, admittedly, in a crisis, but farmers do react and get on with the job and try to find solutions. And I'd like to put that as my first and longest reaction to what you've asked me to do. My second point, I suppose, is that all farmers need water. All farmers need water to grow our food. Many rely on rain. In East Anglia, our vegetable producers rely on a combination of rain, and to make their use more secure, they abstract water. And their needs are very seasonal, as we heard this morning as well. And my question, in the conversations I heard about priority of use, is where does the need for water to grow our food fit in that hierarchy? My third point is that, very unusually in a global context, farmers in England and Wales use only 1% of abstracted water. But more commonly, we do manage 75% of the land. And I would have thought that in terms of the 21,000 abstraction licences that are out there, farmers must have a good 75% of the licences as well. So there's that interesting dichotomy in there. And I've heard a good deal this afternoon or through the day about voluntary approaches, catchment approach, ecosystem services. And my message on that is I think that farmers are really up for that debate. But the situation, the issue is going to be, you know, for a farmer, sell it to me. What's in it for the farmer, and how can we make that work with global commodity prices and local land prices being as they are? But it's not insoluble by any means. There was some conversation this morning about the language, the economic language and the legal language. My own example of this is that at the height of the 2012 drought, and the farmers I was gathering around me to work out NFU various positions, farmers said, we need an entirely new approach to risk management, which sounded great. And then you think, well, yeah, but what does that actually mean? And I would say that farmers could do with some help in understanding better what risk is and what we should do about it. And finally, on a day talking about licences, I wonder what we can do before abstraction reform arrives. We saw under extreme situation last year, the Environment Agency was able to be of significant help to farmers because it moved away from the concept of winter calendar-based licences to fill reservoirs to high-flow licences. Fantastic. Very flexible, very helpful. And I think what I'd like to move on to is how can we improve the system when we're not in crisis? And I think you've probably heard more than enough from me, but thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so we continue on with
basking in the glow of the helpfulness of the Environment Agency that we regularly get from our friends at the NFU on a daily basis. It's good to hear that again. I wanted to talk about three things. So, as I don't have notes in front of me, I will remember them by the acronym SIR: Stuff, Institutions, and Risk. Let's start with stuff. As an economist and as the chief economist of the Environment Agency, I am indeed an economist. I do tend to think in terms of markets or the regulation of economic activity. All markets are about stuff in some way or another. Even service markets are about the stuff of services. So it's absolutely crucial to think about the stuff of water. And a lot of the conversation I heard since I joined the conference about midday, half past midday, has indeed reminded us of that. It's water is a quantity. There is a volume of it. Sometimes there's too little of that volume. Sometimes there's too much. Its location is incredibly important. Water is not the same everywhere. It is different in different places. And, of course, it's not the same at different times. And for instance, the winter-summer division that we used to have was a reflection of that. But actually, it changes very regularly. Look outside, you can see the churl today. There's clearly quite a lot of it about. The amount of water that the fish need for spawning is quite critical, but it's critical over a very specific time of the year. They don't hang around and wait until the water comes and then it all works perfectly. But it can be very important when that high flow time comes in a river. So it's about quantity, it's about the locality, it's about the timings, it's about the quality, obviously. So, for instance, in thinking about the commodity and water abstraction, the commodities create something about how much water is there and it's valuable in different places at different times. If you're thinking about the quality of water, the commodity isn't so much the quality itself as the capacity of the water to deal with inputs from sewage treatment works or runoff from farms or whatever. So water is a very... There's a lot of stuff about water. It's not by any means a simple concept in economic terms. Secondly, let me talk a little bit about institutions. And let's think about a number of different types of institutions. We've talked about property rights and markets, and we've talked about stewardship, and we've talked about rights to water. And I think we are probably at one of those times of institutional change in that sense, when we're trying to define or redefine some of our understandings about the institutions that govern water. And it's very useful to have something like this, where we try to run up economic concepts and environmental concepts against legal concepts and just try to work out what these mean. But of course, it's also about institutions like organizations, whether that's individuals. So I was really struck by things a number of people have said, including, for example, just now about farmers in East Anglia, or coming together. And so starting to think about, if you like, institutions or communities building around abstraction rights or building around catchments. And that's something that we're doing in the Environment Agency, thinking about the institutions with whom we deal on Water Framework Directive. So it's very much a river basin planning approach. So who understands about that river basin? Who understands about the catchments? What about the communities, the interest groups? And how can we build their capacity to understand with, to take ownership, in some kind of sense, of their local catchment, of their local water, so that we can deal with them? But then it's also institutions like the regulatory bodies, and we've already had some discussion about Ofwat and the Environment Agency. And of course, the Environment Agency covers England and Wales at the moment, but from the 1st of April this year, we will have Natural Resources Wales, which takes over the role of the Environment Agency in Wales, but also picks up some of the other environmental institutions on the Welsh side of the border. So we have quite a growing, dare I say, mixed economy of institutions governing water in Great Britain. And some interesting times ahead. At the moment, there is a triennial review of the Environment Agency in Natural England, looking at, among other things, at options for where the boundary between those two bodies lie. I spent a lot of my time on the boundary between the Environment Agency and Ofwat, doing some of that translation work between the two bodies as to how we understand our respective duties. And I think as we go through the Water White Paper, the current water bill, and the longer-term abstraction reform, it's really crucial that the different institutions talk to each other about the different institutional frameworks. And then finally, the R is about risk. And deferring to John's point about... there being a difference between risk and uncertainty. I'm going to somewhat unashamedly talk about risk, but in the sense that sooner or later it all collapses into somebody having to take a decision about something that's either risky or uncertain. I often give my little timeline, my conceptual timeline, that there was a time when all you wanted to do was get water from a place that was wet to a place where there were lots of people who were a bit dry. So you get spectacular Roman aqueducts, you get the wonderful Elan Valley scheme that feeds Welsh water into English Birmingham. They noted the political point there. at the turn of the last century. Actually, what a lot of people tell us now is that it's not so much about shipping water long distances, about managing the risk of not being able to get water out of your tap, not being able to get water out of your irrigation system on your farm. And this is pretty well what we've seen everywhere else. So we talk now about water security, just the same way as we talk about energy security. So very often what we are managing is that risk question. And of course that risk question is then riddled with known, the known and the unknown, the reasonably predictable and the reasonably unpredictable. And of course that reasonably unpredictable goes both ways. Last year in the Environment Agency, you would literally walk from the drought meeting into the flood meeting. Very often you wouldn't even walk. The same people would switch. And if you think that why can we just, because we are all in the same meeting, can we just average out the water? Of course we couldn't, because it was in two different places, the not water and the too much water. So that's very much the business that we see ourselves in. I think it's the business that companies see themselves in. I think it's very much the business that Ofwat sees itself in. And that's where I see things going forward. We're increasingly managing a kind of sophisticated risk system as opposed to just managing the physical system. That influences the institutions that you need. So we talked earlier about planning. John, I don't know, I missed. Did John mention system operator? Did you mention?
I did.
So do you want to say system operator, John?
System operator.
Perfect. John has now mentioned system operator, which cuts to the heart of some of not just the planning, but the thinking about how do you run these systems. And that comes back to the stuff that we are actually managing so that it's in the right place, of the right quality, at the right time. Thanks, Bettina.
Thank you. Okay. Bill, do you want
to say very little to add. I've had my say, but I've enjoyed hearing what the two previous speakers have said. Roman's given us what is essential, I think, this gathering, a perspective from the Environment Agency. Much as these things may interest us as academics or theorists, there's somebody at the end of the day who has to make decisions and decide what is important and what will prevail. If I hadn't been talking about the right to water security, I could have been talking about the right to food security, because I see the two things as very closely interrelated, and the points we made about virtual water could be made similarly about dependence for food on countries and often situations which are not sustainable. We're just exporting environmental problems. So I think the position of the farmers is tremendously important, and the question of what support there should be. I know Chris Smith the other day was talking about the need for reservoirs for farming, and the point about extremes. I've come here today hoping to catch a glimpse of the Cherwell. Can't see it for water.
On that note, I'd like to invite as well any further comments or responses really from the audience in terms of key points in relation to the discussions today, and as well perhaps where you see sort of next steps and taking things forward in terms of own personal areas of research agendas, or more generally where you think the next questions are for thinking about water stewardship.
Kind of picking up actually a few of the ideas that you just touched on, next steps, water security, food security, and the links between the two. At the point at which you start to try and do something about water security or food security, I think the concepts become quite distinct, because food security operates in kind of a globalized market. There are perhaps some very, very extreme scenarios in which self-sufficiency within the UK at the level of food becomes relevant. You know, even in the Second World War, we weren't self-sufficient in food. Actually, we spent most of our naval activities securing supply lines across the Atlantic. That was a lot of the war effort. But water security is an inherently more national issue because it's so expensive to trade water, accepting Bill's important point about the quantity of water that's embedded in the food. So it feels like water security, the way that you would manage the risks around water security is probably qualitatively different. The way you manage food security is you engage in a free international trading market. And that way you ensure that if there's a drought or a flood in the UK, there's plenty of food coming from elsewhere. Similarly, if there's a drought or a flood in Spain, you've got vegetables in the UK or the Netherlands. I don't think at the point at which you talk about next steps in managing water security, you can quite do the same thing. So I wonder if the panel wants to sort of consider that.
I'm always careful to avoid self-sufficiency. I think food security is different. I absolutely agree. Food is a global institution and very complex, and I wouldn't disagree on any of that with you. It seems to me that having two things really, although they're related. We heard about the EU water blueprint this afternoon, and the sort of things I picked up from the Commission's launch of the water blueprint was that in the southern member states of the EU, their problem is illegal abstraction and large-scale over-abstraction already. So that it seems to me that with climate change, many of the potential sources of food that we rely on at the moment, in future droughts, might just not be there. So I agree that it's not that you've got a global and a local, but that to me doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't still move towards making sure that we are in the best position that we can be to source locally as many and as varied foodstuffs as we can. It's bringing it home, really, the idea of that food production.
Very quickly, I mean, over the years, I've just become very conscious and sensitive to the difference between solving environmental problems and simply exporting them. That's to say, we've seen the decline of heavy industry, which has been a major pollution problem, but the transfer of manufacturing to other jurisdictions, we simply buy the manufactured goods. The environmental problem is still there, but happening in other jurisdictions. And I think, or possibly there are counterparts of this in relation to water. I think virtual water is a massively important problem. Are we taking water from other countries that don't have it to spare and worsening some environment, doing more damage through this, as well as the point about self-sufficiency and the unforeseeability of future demands? But I'll say no more.
Liz, I think you wanted to come in as well.
Ask a question about catchment management and payment for ecosystem services that we talked about this afternoon. And I think it's something that Andy and we've been grappling with, exactly how do you apply this in practice. And thinking about what we hope to do in the next investment period, the different catchment management approaches, what does that actually mean? And some activities might be working with farmers and land managers to try to persuade them to voluntarily change their behaviour, reduce the amount of pesticides, for example, that they're applying to land. A different approach that is being discussed is actually to compensate farmers to change their behaviour or to actually pay them to use a different pesticide that has less impact upon the balls that are always easier for us to treat, or to change land management practices to stop that pesticide getting into the water in the first place. So for the coming price review, Ofwat said it's really important for water companies to engage with their customers and to talk to them about what they want to do and to get customer support for their strategies going forward. And I think catchment management, when we've discussed with our stakeholders and customers, the idea of compensating farmers to use a different product or to change their practices is something that's quite unpopular. People feel, customers say, well, why should you be paying farmers not to pollute? Why should that be in my water bill? And I suppose it's a bit of an open question about how that who should actually be paying for that, if it's the food consumer or if it's the water consumer, how best to apply catchment these approaches in reality.
Shall I? Again, going back to the state, the food market is very difficult. Farmers are price takers on food prices. That's not. I don't wish that sounds as the excuse. It probably does. But what I mean by that is that we need to think in a lot more long-term way about what as a society we want our farmers to grow and the quality and the way it's grown. And I think that we've started, if I can just deflect from a second from that, we began to see that last year in terms of the amount of water they supplied to potatoes for their visual appearance, which again came up during the day, I think. And the consumer last year was more willing to buy visually less perfect product. It's down to the consumer. It's a behavioural thing. I think that in terms of, I guess you might be thinking about slug pellets.
That's one of the things that I was thinking about.
Yeah. And I will. There is an issue with metaldehyde, and the situation we are in because it's on a list. Unless anybody in the room tells me differently, has little or no impact on environment or human health,
yeah.
But because it's on a protected list, we need to do something about it. And I have a bit of a problem with that.
Yeah.
And so it's a question of what we want to do as society, really. And I think that there are good examples from across Europe of farmers being incentivised to change. To change their practices for society's good, and I haven't got a problem with that.
Yes, Tim, there. Oh, sorry. Let's first have kind of the panelists' responses before we go to the audience. Yes.
Yeah. So I think this is a good example of where that set of expectations are changing, and they're changing among consumers. They're obviously changing, and throughout the food supply chain. And the reaction of the retailers and their suppliers, and clearly issues far, far away from water have made the entire food chain have a really serious think about traceability and about the quality of that supply chain. But that is influencing water. The line that we tend to take is there should be a fairly clear baseline that the farming community, the food producing community, should be able to work to, so that it is kind of clear and agreed that what one expects of people. You can't have it kind of randomly dotted around. That baseline itself may change over time because expectations change and what people believe is the right thing for a society to do may change. So that baseline itself may have to be developed and changed. Anybody who tries to cheat in the baseline, but, you know, that's a bad thing to do and deserves appropriate treatment. Anybody who wants to go beyond the baseline, perhaps incentives there are entirely appropriate. And I think water companies, a few in particular, have been looking at this over the last few years, and there have been places where I would say water companies are really managing their supply chains well. What do I mean by that? I mean, they've been going out and talking to farmers who've been doing perfectly normal farming practice and saying, look, unfortunately, you're doing perfectly normal farming practice on top of an aquifer that's really important for us. So can we not come to some agreement that changes how that works? And that seems to be perfectly good business practice. Over time, we might be able to make that a norm across the entire other sector. And then from that basis, we will move forward. You have to bear in mind that a lot of this, though, is against the background of things like REACH, which you referred earlier, Bill. It is a massive piece of legislation. It's incredibly important in this. That's changing the baseline, too. So I think things that people were paid to do sometime in the past, they may well have to do sometime in the future. They may well be punished for doing sometime beyond that. And it could go the other way, because as we develop these norms. What the ecosystem services idea is trying to do is to try to help define better what that set of things is with respect to the environment. And that might include something like upstream flood storage. A really good example from our point of view. It's really important for us that there are times when you want to flood a farmer's field upstream, and we have situations around the country where we have contracts with farmers which say if floodwaters rise to a certain level, we will flood your land, and here's the appropriate payment for that. And the farmer takes that as a kind of commercial deal, and if that happens to flood a crop that was going to be fantastically good that year, that is just the unfortunate consequence of an otherwise perfectly legitimate decision they made. If it happens that that's just an empty field because they're not using it at the moment, good for the farmer. So it is these kind of transactions that have become increasingly important. And I think the ecosystem approach is helping us structure that thinking better. It is not a panacea. And we're not going to, you know, the Office of Ecosystem Services Regulation hasn't yet been set up. It may have its moment, but it's not there yet. And we're quite some distance away from it, I would think.
Just very quickly on that original point, if there's anybody here, lawyer or economist, who's come down looking for a research project, the one I'm thinking of is Article 9 of the Water Framework Directive, which is the one about cost recovery for water services, which, I mean, it wouldn't be right to ask Henry, because I suspect it's not his department, but which DEFRA has confidently implemented, because we have a privatised water industry, they must recover their costs. But it's not just economic costs, it's environmental costs, and how costs of water treatment are met by others who cause that harm. And, I mean, and again, in support of farmers, I mean, what they want is a level playing field, a similar set of restrictions on what pesticides can and cannot be used. It's not that they're wanting to do these things unilaterally, it's just that they have to be comparable with other farmers in their practice.
So there were a couple of responses from the audience. Shall we start back again?
And I was just wondering, with paying ecosystem services, is there a danger that whilst you're incentivising farmers to have better practices for the environment, that they're not already doing so, does that disincentivise farmers who already have more environmentally friendly practices? They see their neighbour or another farmer being paid to do something that they're already doing.
I don't know. I mean, in terms of maybe the catchment approach that I've been involved in, it is really more of a case of let me use the example of phosphates or nitrates. It's really more a case of if you can identify some relatively small, really key fields or sites or points, and concentrate on dealing with those locations that you get some really, really big wins. And I think sometimes the problem I have with when we're thinking about diffuse pollution and all of, you know, pesticides, all the rest of it, is like, because of the nature of the countryside, no two farms are the same. What different farmers are doing, different things, different topography, and all the rest of it. It's getting, and that's the value of the catchment approach to me. It's getting down to what you can really achieve well on specific areas. So it doesn't necessarily apply to, apply, I think, in terms of what one farmer's doing, what it might affect his next door neighbour. Because if you've made contact and you're working with the right person, it's potentially job done.
I wanted to respond to two invitations you put out, Bettina. One to talk about the ideological debate, and one to talk a little bit about my own research. And I think some of the things I'm going to say are probably a little bit obvious, but we've hedged a little bit around the ideological debate and the issue about what is the ideology around water. Water is totally different from all other products. It's different from food, in comparison. Yeah, it's as essential as food, but without water there's no food. You've got the hydrological cycle of water. It's always there, it's not always in, described it beautifully, and where's the River Cher? Well, you can't see it for the water. I mean, it's not always where you want it, when you want it, but it's always there, and it comes back and it goes around. I mean, that's implicit in what we've all been talking about, but I think it's rather a critical point that we contemplate. And in relation to the sort of work that I've been doing, looking in at water and sanitation supplies in informal settlements in different African countries, it can be quite illuminating to see the difference. And we've been very local about our debate, obviously. Water is a local issue. We've got to deal with our water problems here, because we're not going to be importing it any further more from Scotland. But if you look at the approach in the developing world and in the informal settlements, where they have lots of regulation, and the regulations reflect some of our 19th century laws and the rest of it. They don't have the latest sort of batch of plethora of legislation that we've been talking about this afternoon, but there's a lot of regulation there. And there are bits of markets operating at the same time. And the truth is, neither are working. Neither are working effectively. The regulations don't really achieve anything without the political will and lack of corruption and the rest of it to make municipal systems work. And, we are sitting here in this extraordinarily privileged position, really tinkering around a system that is absolutely phenomenal, what we've got. And it's the product of wealth creation over sort of 200 years that we've seen it develop here. So that we're not actually talking about a problem of pipe supply. We've got pipe supplies. We're not talking about a problem of dying from cholera. We don't die from cholera anymore. We barely have any waterborne diseases unless someone sticks the aluminium in the wrong place. There's no issue about health from water. And I'm making a broad statement. I'm sure you can tell me I'm wrong in this or that respect, but it's unarguable, really. When you compare the situation where you've got regulatory frameworks in developing countries that fail to bring piped water to every household, or that where they do bring water, it's in inadequate quantities and inadequate quality. And then you've got the market operating in those countries that's operating on a micro scale. And it serves a purpose. It improves access to water. So some people are getting water that wouldn't have had it otherwise, or wouldn't have had it in sufficient quantities. And we're talking about the 20 litres per day baseline. And I've forgotten what the figure is that we consume, but it's way beyond way beyond that. And the market that's operating in these countries, you know, has its place, because without it, people would not have enough water to survive. But the fact is, they're buying water that comes from unimproved sources, so it carries all those health hazards with it. And the truth is that as soon as they sort out the municipal supplies, that market will disappear. It will be eradicated. And it will be rightfully eradicated, because it's while it's achieving a stopgap provision, it's not solving the problem about access to water of a decent quality. So I raise that as a contrast, really, because you've got there a system that is, you know, 100 years behind. I in terms of the development, it's got that patchwork development in it. How would we solve that problem? And there are useful parallels, I think, to consider in terms of what we've been talking about today, because we are being very far-seeing about identifying the problem. Somebody earlier on gave the projection that we're not, I think it was Karen in the very first paper this morning, pointed out that we're not yet at the point where it's a crisis. So, you know, that's good news that we're sitting here talking about it before it is a crisis. But clearly we do need to think about water security in the future. We are beyond the point when we need to do panic things. We have structures in place, we have regulators in place that do a pretty good job, if I can sort of patronisingly say that. And I could sit here in another day and point out all the failings of the Environment Agency in prosecuting and all the rest of it. But the truth is that we have a regulatory framework that really more or less works. We have a water supply that more or less works. So taking us back to the ideological debate about how to ensure water security for the next 100, 200 years, and so on. I'm quite sure that one should talk about 1,000 years in this context, but let's not be too ambitious. Then what is it why are we talking about major changes in our approach that are based on very much the political fashions and political approaches that are not actually necessary for us to improve that long-term security, which is what we're talking about. Now, where we have structures that by and large serve our needs, why transform those into something different with these rather sort of strange liberalisation agendas that mean different things in different parts of the European Union? We've gone down that route with all our utilities except for water, and I'm not sure that we've really gained in terms of transport policy, energy policy, and the rest of it. It does seem to me that we need to have that ideological debate about the use of markets for water and for the provision of water, rather than there seems to be something of there's. People have talked about the lawyers and the economists, and I'm trying to avoid saying that, but I can't avoid it, really. The economist's perspective, that market is the solution, as opposed to the lawyer's perspective, and I'm there is a place for markets, but not one, I would argue, in relation to the provision of something as basic and fundamental as a water supply.
But I think I'd seen earlier perhaps responses from Henry and John, so it would be really interesting to hear from on the economists. Or Defra, kind of, I think it's really interesting as well about understanding the public policy making process. So what makes the department very interested in pursuing the ideas around thinking about markets? And earlier, kind of in the session this morning, I was just literally wondering as well why in the draft water bill introducing certain types of competition upstream water markets was prioritized over having the abstraction licensing reform, kind of why that came later. So, yeah, just to understand kind of how policymakers become receptive to particular types of ideas, and to hear the economist's case again.
Well, I think I'll start. I think actually it links to what I was going to say anyway, which was to talk about the difference between water scarcity and drought. Because I think one of the points that was made earlier, last week picked on, is there's no crisis. Well, actually, we do have water scarcity and we sometimes have drought, and we do try and distinguish between these two things. So we're limited, to some extent limited success in terms of, I think, wider understanding because of the pictures people have of water and what impinges on their consciousness and the sense of a crisis, that it's about a crisis and so forth. The easiest way I have of trying to understand it myself is it's the difference between a chronic problem and an acute problem. And you can have a chronic problem of water scarcity, which is that you're broadly putting too much pressure on the environment over a long period, without necessarily having a drought, and vice versa. And this is quite an important distinction, I think, because in terms of how people's values, how they see it and so forth, it's a bit akin, I think, to the distinguishing between what people think they should do as a matter of normal practice and what people should be paid to do. And the equivalent slightly in the water availability area of that, or the water quantity, is that people think that people should maybe act normally during sort of everyday processes of water, and maybe people aren't too worried about markets in that situation where water is scarce. And then when you've got a crisis, a drought, and we're all in it together and it's emergency, and suddenly people say, look, it's out of people's control, we're all got to team together, then we're into hierarchies, what's the most important, who should get the water? The question is there a sort of boundary between that? So I'd say first, we are facing a problem of water scarcity and drought every now and again. So it's not that the crisis hasn't happened. We already are impinging on the environment in a number of places, and that's going to get a lot worse. So that's why we're acting now. What we're also saying is that within normal everyday water scarcity, the chronic problem, if you like, rather than the emergency and the crisis, it is reasonable to use markets. In actual fact, of course, the rights are private anyway, and markets exist anyway. Water is trading. That's the reality. I mean, and we've seen this morning all the discussion about how the history of water is actually, in many cases, private. And we're moving towards a more public system. But we have a market in water rights at the moment. It's just not very active. We think in normal day-to-day processes around a chronic problem, then markets have a place, which they may not have in a crisis drought. The problem is having a clear divide between those situations in people's perceptions, in their value judgments, and so forth. And we saw a discussion earlier where it's very easy to muddle up these two things. We're talking water security and avoiding risk of not having any water. We're probably in drought territory. And probably there aren't going to be droughts in every place in all of the world all at the same time. And so international trade is probably a good insurance policy to avoid the effects of drought. However, over-abstraction, chronic over-abstraction over long periods internationally, where we're importing damage from other countries, which is a chronic problem in other countries, which we're on the back of and encouraging, is probably not a good thing. So when we're talking about risk management, here's what sort of risks are we talking about, who should bear them? Because that's when we talk about risks, should that be a private risk? In Australia, they've tried to set the principle that it's actually abstractors who should manage the risks of climate change. That it should come down to individual abstractors to build their own reservoirs, to take whatever other managers to manage the risk. So that's a private risk. But then in drought, in emergency, we think it's probably a public risk that people should come along and help people out. So I suppose there is quite a complicated situation here where there are some circumstances around water where there seems to be an immediate sort of response that this is a public thing, this is a problem, a public problem with a public solution, and private is inappropriate. But I think there are other situations, and I think chronic water scarcity is one, where the market can have a role, and already does, and facilitating it has a benefit. The problem is, when does the switchover come, and how do you manage that line so that people say, I won't manage my own risk, because I know if things get really tough, someone will come help me out. And therefore the farmer that invests in the reservoir is effectively subsidising the farmer down the road who says, oh, well, I'll just say food security, food's too important, give me the water, and the environment can go stuck. So that's, of course, that never happens. But I'm just saying that there's a problem with free riders, there's a problem with a grey area between water scarcity and managing that, a chronic problem over the long term, and a sort of emergency public, this is water, this is about life and death, and the market isn't appropriate. And how we sort of sort between those different areas and come up with a consensus about what the different, how the areas should be dealt with and what is appropriate in different areas is probably the key to solving this problem.
Thank you, John. Yes, yeah.
Thank you. I think this bit of discussion has brought out an area that has cropped up in various places and we haven't talked about explicitly today, and that's policy objectives. Policy objectives somehow get set, and both law and economics and other disciplines are involved in setting that, and there are also means by which policy objectives get translated into regulatory frameworks in particular, and good regulators need decent policy frameworks. And my impression is that in water, the policy objectives are less well set out, are less clear. There's more conflict between them than they are in some of the other major utilities, major infrastructure industries. And clearly, I'm thinking in terms of the African context and others, the appropriate policy objectives are what follows from them. Clearly very different from what they are in Europe, and the means of delivering them is all going to be very different. In terms of trailing the markets and so on, Henry's quite right about trading, and the arguments about encouraging trading are that it should increase the resilience and flexibility and mean that droughts, as Henry defined them, are less likely to happen, you know, because you're building in this resilience and so on. And maybe they will, maybe they won't. And water companies, when consulted by Alfort, were all very keen on more trading. They weren't very keen on more competition. I'm in favour of competition and taking action to enforce both upstream and downstream competition, but I'm in a minority of kind of one and a half. And that is an agenda to those that's been clearly been rejected for at least the short to medium term, possibly longer in the UK. So the idea that water markets are going to go down the way of electricity markets in the foreseeable future in the UK is very unlikely, although one of the things I did want to take up in terms of I think a lot of the debates that we've had have hinged around notions of centralisation and decentralisation, which has been floating around. And one of course the key characteristics of Britain is we're becoming certainly a confederal, if not a federal country. And water is an entirely devolved in Scotland, and is, I think, de facto becoming more devolved in Wales. So within Britain, there is some decentralisation. The interesting question is whether that is going to lead to more centralised policy and regulation in Wales and Scotland than when is treated only one, and it may do. And I think a lot of the discussion about appropriate policies and roles of different things, the roles of markets, hinges on centralisation and decentralisation. And my main defence of markets would be it allows decentralisation flexibility with minimum information sharing requirements. But if you're operating in smaller entities, one would not want to argue that for Luxembourg. whether where Scotland or Wales are on that continuum, you know, political differences, I think it kind of is interesting. Final point I'd make is that this is always the conversations that I go to the water, sewerage and wastewater get sort of relegated really into the background. And in fact, over 60% of water bills come from the sewerage side. Most of the health benefits that have arisen from clean water and so on have arisen on the wastewater and sewerage side. Hedley was careful to say that sort of that net abstraction rather than gross abstractions, but within this kind of water debate, I think it would be really very helpful. I'm guilty of the sin of trying to integrate rather more discussions of wastewater and wastewater management within water contexts.
I'm conscious of the time as well, so I'm wondering if there are any sort of final responses from the panelists to the points raised by members from the audience.
My final comment on the food security and our ability as a wealthy nation to buy in the food that we need. Again, going back to 12 months ago, and within the NFU, we dealt with a huge volume of media inquiries about what was happening down on the farm because of the drought. And the only thing, let me tell you, that the only thing the media interested in is what will be the impact of what's happening to the farmers, what will be the impact on food prices. And that's and I guess that food pricing is highly political. And it certainly made me think about, in terms of the work that the NFU's done in terms of lessons learned from the drought. We never got there, did we? But because we had such a close miss. That particular political issue of food price volatility, I think, is quite important.
That just makes me speculate on a piece of economic research that might be quite interesting to, which is what is the swing impact of water scarcity on food prices, given what we saw in commodity prices over recent years with the extreme drought in the American Midwest. It could actually be much greater than people's water bills in this country. Mm. So it would be quite interesting to reflect on that. Because I was actually going to reflect on a piece of work for lawyers, not economists, if I might, just in case any comes our way, bat it away quickly. Which is, I think there is certainly something around this change, what I would see as an evolution in the way we approach water. And in some kind of better understanding of the institutions and how they exist legally. So, for example, the catchment approach. Do we actually have a legal framework, an institutional framework, for delivering a catchment approach? If, catchment approach is a lot more fine-grained than the England, Wales, Scotland graining is, but what exactly exists at that level to deliver that fine grain? But also then the questions, perhaps it's not so much as whose water as who can do what with the water, does need to be understood better. I always think that we don't have our water issue in this country is very much about people's use of water through quite sophisticated systems, which you've developed over a long period of time, as opposed to much less sophisticated systems, as you were saying, not zero systems. People imagine there are no systems, but there are definitely systems, and they do evolve over time. But to understand a little bit more about the evolution of those systems and where we've come from, and I say this partly because we've done a little bit of this work in waste recently, where, again, you find there's a very active waste system in the mega cities around the world, which don't have the kind of waste collection, waste disposal systems that we have, but they definitely have systems. And there's quite a lot to be learned from that.
Thank you. Yeah, okay, good.
I just wanted to say I had a lovely day. It's been great listening to all these talks. It's been tremendously stimulating the different discussions I've had, so thanks for asking me.
Sure, yeah. And on that note as well, I'd like to thank all of the panelists for the different presentations throughout the day, and as well great contributions from a very active audience. And yes, I very much enjoyed really as well very interesting, wide-ranging discussions. So thank you very much.